Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 90, Audacious Hospitality. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we are back in our continuing exploration of Reform Judaism, the idea and the movement in the lead up to the Reform Movement's biennial meeting, which is coming up in about a month in Boston. We talked with Rabbi Daniel Freelander, the president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, about the history of Reform Judaism. And we talked to Rabbi Rick Jacobs last week. He's the president of the Union for Reform Judaism, essentially the leader of the movement in America, about the present of Reform Judaism and the current ideas animating the Reform movement. And this week we're going to be talking to April Baskin. She is the vice president of Audacious Hospitality at the Union for Reform Judaism. We're excited to get into understanding what that means. Before coming to the Union for Reform Judaism in 2015, April Baskin served as the National Director of Resources and Training at Interfaith Family. She is the immediate past president of the Jewish Multiracial Network and has been named one of 12 faith leaders to watch in 2017 by the Centers for American Progress. So we're really excited to talk to April to get into this question of audacious hospitality and what that means and how the Reform movement is thinking about its future and experimenting on the ground to bring that future about, which is going to be the topic of the next few episodes. So welcome back as we get into this conversation about Reform Judaism today and tomorrow. And April Baskin, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's great to have you.
It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to have a conversation with both of you today.
Yeah, we're really excited. I mean, I think that I've been thinking about this conversation and wanting to ask, I know the question that everybody asks you first, but I actually have a little bit of a spin on it, which is, could you just share with our listeners a little bit about what it means to be the vice president for Audacious Hospitality? But particularly, I'm interested in what the difference is between hospitality and audacious hospitality.
That is the perpetual question. Within a Jewish context, it's about welcoming all. And if we think of our community as in that broad sense, and that's really complicated, but if we simplify it and think of our community in terms of existing within a tent, audacious hospitality is thinking about how we push out the tent poles to make room for more people and how we think about how the tent is designed and who it was originally designed for and if that design speaks to the needs and identities of Jews today. For me, audacious shows up, it's sort of in some ways both the agitational but also redeeming quality of hospitality. And audacious hospitality shows up because for me, it's about moving beyond simply being about welcoming in the other person, but doing work on a deeper level that says that I'm so committed, we as a community are so committed to this, that if we are really doing hospitality, again, described loosely because you could call it community building, you could call it a number of different things, that if we're doing it well, it's actually going to shift how we are as a people. When we invite those people to the table, it's going to shift what we have on the table and when we're meeting. And lastly, I would say that I love that in some ways to me, it's a shout out to Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel and his speaking of moral grandeur and spiritual audacity. To me, it's about courage. It's sort of a way of thinking of inclusion and hospitality and diversity as a tekiah moment, as sort of a wake-up call to really be bold and courageous and to function beyond, step outside of the normative practice, because that normative practice has left 60% of our community not engaging in Jewish communal life, which to me is a call to action for us to reconsider our practices. We tend to perceive ourselves as being more welcoming than we actually are in practice. There was a study done almost 10 years ago where there was a secret shul shopper, a secret synagogue shopper study done informally throughout North America, and the findings, and pardon me because I don't remember all of the specifics of it, but the findings that were relayed to me by a former leader was that none of the secret synagogue shoppers received any welcome. And most of these communities say that they're welcoming. So to me, that there's a disconnect somewhere between the way the community perceives itself and how other people are receiving it and what they're actually doing. And I think that that's more complex, and we can get into that. Just really briefly, I would say that part of that is just around having greater awareness. And then I also think that there are, and training around how to be welcoming. And I think that there's a deeper element there of a reality. And I don't mean this as a pass, but just a source of compassion and awareness. There are also realities around anti-Semitism and Christian hegemony that Jewish community has to navigate. And I think that that does take a toll. Like white Christian communities don't have to have a security guard at the front of their community. And I think that that takes its toll, but that also isn't an excuse for us to still not raise the bar and do better.
So it's funny you mentioned that secret shill shopper study. I wasn't somebody who was officially part of this study, but I remember hearing about it, and I decided in one of my waves of Jewish cynicism that comes around pretty frequently, as none of our listeners will be surprised by, I decided to do this myself. I was in, it did happen to be a Reformed congregation. I was there for the first time for high holidays. My mom was living in, well, I don't want to name this. My mom was in a place where she hadn't been before. And I was visiting her for the high holidays, and I went to services. And I was with her for the services themselves, but afterwards she wanted to start baking and cooking and do some fun stuff for Rosh Hashanah, and I occasionally help with that, and she's appreciative, and sometimes she wants me not to be there, and she wants me to do
totally
other things.
Totally get it.
And that year was one that I was like, okay, I'll go to Tashlich. I'll go to, you know, the service that's often done in conjunction with Rosh Hashanah, where you cast your sins and bread into the water. And so I went to the congregation's Tashlich. This was a very big congregation. And I decided I was going to do this experiment. And I was just going to go and not sort of instigate any. I'm naturally a pretty outgoing. I start a lot of conversations with people, but I was just going to see what happens if I don't. And so there were probably 100-ish people, and we met at the congregation, and we walked from the congregation to a body of water that was close by, and I was right next to people this entire walk, probably half a mile, and nobody said anything to me, like actually no words, like zero, and it was this strange experience, and really, really a bummer for me. And it helped me, because I'm very deeply immersed in the Jewish world. It helped me empathize with people who aren't as comfortable in those spaces. Cause I could have, if I wanted to, you know, I know what Tashlich is. I know how to drop the right lingo and do the right things, whatever, but I didn't, just to see. And a lot of people don't have that. And so it was an important moment for me, but it was also kind of tragic and devastating to see that's how this goes down.
Opportunity. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And I'm sorry that happened. And like you said, I'm glad that you have a really solid grounding, because a number of people don't. And they have a variety of experiences that have a number of similar elements to the story that you shared. It happens too often. And I often think of part of my work, which I function from a place of non-judgment, but also of a real attempt at honesty and an assessment. And let's actually see what's happening here and analyze it and change our behavior so that we can get different results. And part of that is around taking proactive action in my mind and shifting some of these dynamics. And there's a lot, there are decades of hurt, of repeated experiences ranging from this to people finding out. I have heard of, again, not coming from a place of judgment, but just like, we need this information so that we can properly analyze and diagnose the situation and take a different course of action. But I've heard from too many interfaith families that It goes something along the lines of a week before their child's bar bat mitzvah, they found out that one of their parents was not allowed to join them on the bima. And they were deeply hurt by that. And they'd been involved for a number of years and they left and didn't come back or some kind of version of that. And so I'm also navigating. So there's like the real time issues and there's a backlog of hurt that's very real and that we need to find ways of addressing it.
Brings up the question that I was thinking about before, which is that when we're talking about this idea of being more welcoming, I'm curious sort of how you think about it or how we should be thinking about it in terms of who are the people that we're trying to be audaciously hospitable to, you know, and at first, as I'm thinking about that, my mind is of course starting with Jews of color and intermarried people and, and you know, LGBT people and, you know, we sort of get the whole list going. And then as I was thinking it through, I was thinking, who actually is comfortable? Right. You know, meaning like,
especially in the Jewish community.
Right. Like I'm just, and
it's a lot of trauma.
There's a piece of, right. And there's a piece of that that actually struck me in the response to our podcast, which surprised me also, where all of a sudden there were all these different kinds of people that were writing into us, telling us how meaningful it was to listen to this podcast. And all of a sudden I kind of realized that it's actually a majority that feels excluded, a minority that feels included, but the majority acts like a minority because they don't speak to each other, so they don't recognize that they're actually the majority. And so I'm just sort of curious, just both to talk in the more, let's say, obvious level of just saying, well, who are the groups that are primarily on the minds of the URJ as it's thinking about where our real work of hospitality needs to go? Because clearly that is groups like Jews of color and intermarried Jews, I think, intermarried families. But you know, what are the other sort of groups that you've been thinking about, that you've been working with, that have had positive experiences with? But also that second question of, you know, well maybe the whole project is sort of a lot more interesting and different than we thought, because if it turns out that it really is a very small minority that feels included, that seems to be a major topic of concern and an opportunity.
Oh, Dan. So that's a great question, and we could take the whole hour on this alone. Like, I could break this down for you in so many different ways. We could parse this stuff out. So I have like three bullets here of different directions and places where I could go with this. I'll try to be concise with each one. So yes to everything you said, and that's why we said we start by saying that audacious hospitality is about welcoming all. For that very reason, I often, to give sort of a baseline, I think of our work of audacious hospitality as having three primary contexts. There is within the congregation, which is really important. There's a threshold, both physical thresholds as well as threshold moments where people are first encountering when they're first walking into a community and trying out a tashlich or other high holiday service, right? And then there's the external outside stuff, both on land and online. And for me, I've been doing this work for a while now, and worked at Interfaith Family and with the Jewish Multiracial Network. And whenever congregations would come to me and ask for support around outreach, to me, the first piece of outreach is always just ensuring that the congregation has really meaningful and inclusive policies to begin with. Because especially in my role, I feel accountable to the people who I am welcoming into communal spaces. And if those spaces aren't ready for them, like, we need to pre-pave a path. When my colleagues at the URJ or when congregations really want to do more effective work around, say, gender inclusion in terms of transgender individuals and gender nonconforming people, I often pause and say, well, is this conference ready to host them? Are we prepared to compensate them? Have we thought through just some of the basics around having an all-gender bathroom? Have we done the work that's necessary before they get there to ensure when they show up that it's a validating experience, that they feel seen and accounted for. And so similarly, that's not to say at all, as often is the case and as a challenge, one of the challenges with the name of this work is that audacious hospitality is not about being all things to all people all the time. It is about a baseline accountability and greater cultural awareness and social capacity and ability to navigate challenge and difference. But to loop back, so we have those three contexts just as a groundwork. And I often say that because to me, if a congregation is losing members, one, we just need to stop that trend. Like if the people who was made, if it's not working for those people, I don't even want us to get to the other piece yet because we haven't dealt with the problem to begin with. And I think that we're dealing with the piece where there are so many people who are just barely in. We're just barely in. And I want that to change. I want our communities to shift, to be more relational, to be more agile, to be able to have conversations with people. And after 10 conversations here, oh, there's a trend. It isn't quite this simple, but often I think because of our analysis and our funding in the Jewish community, we miss the fact that if you ask people good questions and you just listen, they will tell you what they need and what they want. And if you deliver that, they will show up. And I want to find ways to bring them in. And one of the ways that we're doing that is through our Juvenation Fellowship. And we brought a number of different voices into our ecosystem in its first cohort. And for the second cohort, which we're looking at launching in the spring, it's going to be an all Jews of color cohort that's going to hopefully be a pipeline for leadership within our community, for Jews of color within the Reform movement to begin to provide more visibility around that issue. And so I'm looking at different strategies and tactics to begin to raise the visibility of people who aren't seen. And part of what I hold, Dan, and you know, I would love your thinking around this either in this conversation or afterward, is I agree with you that there is a silent majority of people who don't feel fully included. And there are a number of different elements there. And then within that, I try to parse it out a little bit to begin to distinguish. It's all of it is significant and is worthy of being addressed. But to me, I place a different level of priority around people who have chronically not been allowed into the space, who are not able to participate in life cycle events, who aren't getting a religious school education or an informal education because of financial or cultural barriers or because their parents are consistently confused as hired help when they walk in. That is on, and I don't want to place it in a hierarchy, but that to me feels quantitatively and qualitatively different than someone's views being challenged who still has access to all of the resources that the community has to offer.
I'd love to hear more about that. Just because I know, I mean, it's funny, we're video chatting as we speak, and there's this incredible whiteboard in the far background. I can't read the words, but it says Audacious Hospitality in big letters, and I can see hundreds of words beneath, and it's clear that, and different colors, it's clear that you've got all sorts of stuff happening, I'm sure, focused on many of the groups that would fit in this category you're outlining of people who have historically or even now been actually barred explicitly or implicitly from spaces. I'd love to hear more. So when you allude to situations like people whose parents or who themselves are confused as hired help, that might be clear to us. You know, we're probably talking about Jews of color there, or
correct,
Jews in families that have people who aren't Jewish who are of color or are Jewish, etc. What are some of those other groups that in a literal sense have been prevented from having access historically and currently, and what is the Audacious Hospitality crew department looking how are you operating with respect to them?
My thesis, based around the data I've seen, a number of different studies, all of that compiled in my mind, one of the summaries of all of those different communal studies is that there may be more recent data out. So pardon me if this is a couple years old, but you know, there was a study, I believe this came out of Pew, a study that demonstrated that 60% of Jews are not currently affiliated with Jewish institutional life. And in both other studies I've seen, as well as anecdotal information from the thesis I wrote about Jews of color, to tracking what I've seen around the country in terms of who's showing up, that 60% includes disproportionately Jews of color, LGBTQ Jews, Jews with disabilities, Jews from interfaith families, and Jews who are poor or working class. But for me, I want to bring in more of those voices because I think it's just the right thing to do. And because I think I've noticed now in the past couple of years, I notice both movements and certain professions or groups, identity groups, that are great sources of change. And I love what comes out of the disability advocacy movement. I love their saying nothing about us without us. I use it all the time. It's one of the core tenets of Audacious Hospitality, is that we have to center the voices of the people who are most directly affected. And recently I heard a theory that came out of their movement that I bring a more intersectional approach to. And I think Audacious Hospitality builds on that and makes it better, is their concept of universal design, which is this concept that if we are to include everyone, including those on the margins, and take that into account for everyone, that it's going to improve the experience of everyone. And I have a variety of examples of that I often talk about. I often give like three around how if we have mezuzot, if we have mezuzahs, the posting that goes on the door frame at a level that people in wheelchairs can reach, that just made that mezuzah accessible to every kid and every small person in your synagogue. If our synagogues are better at welcoming people of other faith backgrounds and provide a lot more English and opportunities to learn that are approachable, your synagogue just got way more easier for a whole bunch of Jews who have been disconnected or who never went to religious school, right? Like, I could just, as you can see, you kind of get the theme.
So I'm interested in kind of like thinking that through also. So let's take people with disabilities, for example. So we're going to have, you know, let's say category one. I would love to join this synagogue, except for the ways in which it's not designed well for me, both physically and maybe in other dimensions of it. And so we can change that, right? We can move where the mezuzahs are. We can find ways of, coming to the Torah without having to walk around, you know, whatever the barriers may be. And obviously, you know, and for every group, it's different, right? Like you were saying earlier, for trans people, it would be the bathrooms aren't the right bathrooms. So we can be as nice and welcoming as we want. But if the people ultimately come in and the space isn't really open to them, then we haven't really done what we've pretended, or what we've pretended in our own minds that we've done, what we really honestly think that we've done and wish that we had done, but we didn't really do it because we didn't, you know, get deeply enough into it. So that's sort of a category one, which I think is relatively clear. Then I was thinking though about category two, which is like almost to think, what if these folks had been part of the design of this an enterprise from the beginning, right? How many things that are going on here today would be different profoundly, right? Because we had actually, it was not only that this thing that was created by cis white people, right, that became then more open, it wouldn't be that. It would be actually something that had been created by this collective in the first place and would integrate a lot of the perspectives and needs of all of these other folks from the beginning. And the question in a sense is like, how do we get there? Is that part of the aspiration? You know, and then but then the other sort of category that I was trying to put out there was, and there are also probably, right, lots of people with disabilities and LGBT folks and intermarried folks who just, you know, don't believe in God. But let's talk, can we talk a little bit about the middle category, by which I mean that, You know, it's interesting. I once went to Willow Creek Community Church, which is a major evangelical church that is amazingly good at hospitality, right? You go in there and people, you know, are just so thrilled to see you and immediately, you know, are totally there for you. And when I was there, I now we could say, you know, well, what are they trying to achieve and everything, right? But nevertheless, yeah, it's an incredible feeling of hospitality. And mm-hmm. It was interesting because when I spoke to the people there and asked them, you know, how do you do this? You know, how do you spend all of this energy on hospitality on Sunday mornings? And they say, oh, well, we have our services on Wednesday evenings, you know, meaning that they were doing solely hospitality work at that time, and that they had a separate time where they weren't doing hospitality, right? That was sort of the way that they solved that challenge, right? And mm-hmm. So, you know, the point is that for this like first category of people that really they would be interested in what we're doing, but for the fact that they don't feel welcome enough, the question becomes, you know, how can we really do it? How can we be so welcoming? You know, but then there's the sort of, I think what we would call the kind of privilege question, right? The fact that I think a lot of the people within Jewish institutions, synagogues and all sorts of other institutions, don't fully realize that in a way that's not even enough, right? Because in a way, it's not recognizing that the way that we're doing things today, the basic fundamental things that we're doing Jewishly, we wouldn't be doing them this way had those people been involved from the beginning.
I'm in the throes of trying to navigate, if I understood your categories, both of those categories. And if I can refer to some of the literature material that my team has produced, we have 6 guiding principles of audacious hospitality that are based around midot, that are based around classic Jewish values, a number that are connected to Musar and the study, intensive study of Jewish values. And it starts with welcome. And it starts with like Hachnas Arachim of welcoming guests and Ohel Patuach, an open tent. And I think that's often what people think audacious hospitality is. And there are 6 other values that we have that when I think of this work, this body of work that it entails, and where it lands, just to sort of cut to the chase, is around leadership and justice. And it's this concept that our leadership and justice work in the world is going to look very differently if we go through a process of truly having an open tent, of doing watchfulness and assessment, of taking time to do a lot of self-reflection, to take cultural competence and bias studies, like studies to be aware of where we think we are versus where we actually land. Anyway, it continues through knowledge and self-awareness. Once we do an assessment around what we need, likely there's going to be collective learning that needs to take place in a community to begin to shift understanding. We need to honor diversity. This concept of kavod, which I loved it as a Hebrew school teacher, I love it now, this idea of not only respect but honor. If we really, it's not just about welcoming, like that's the common phrase, but in some of my materials, one may notice that a colleague pointed out at a Jewish social justice roundtable meeting the other day in some of the materials that I shared, they found it refreshing that it actually didn't have welcome written anywhere. It was more about who's actually already here, who we're just not seeing, who if we notice them and acknowledge them and engage their talents and insights, we could begin to have different conversations. And the principles continue on through courage and compassion in the do area, where I call it sort of the when the rubber meets the road. There's a reason why some of these efforts haven't, it's not like there are very few concepts associated with the work of audacious hospitality that are new. It's just that we are trying to find ways of getting past the obstruction and the challenges that have prevented communities who wanted to make these changes before from doing them, is actually saying, what's happening here? Okay, we had a young person on the border, we had this initiative take place, and then it fell through, it didn't work out. Okay, so in this community, what do we need to work on? Young people's voices aren't being listened to. Like they're actually saying and leading, and that leadership isn't being met with kavod and trust and a willingness with experimentation. So let's figure that out. Let's pinpoint exactly what is getting in the way of us moving forward and finding ways of addressing it. And if we were to take, where would we be if Jews of color had been involved from the beginning? It's hard for me to even imagine. My reality as a Jewish woman of color is so not that. But I can tell you now what it looks like in terms of my leadership is beginning to shift the nature of the way we talk about it. To say, when we have these conversations, yes, we are still a predominantly Jewish community, but I want our community to begin to see itself as a multiracial Jewish community. And that is a very different place to enter a whole variety of conversations.
I want to talk about, so this has come up in little bits and pieces here and there, but I want to delve in fully, because I think sometimes in the world of inclusion, hospitality, empowerment, whichever word in that world of work, this the issue of economics often is not what we're thinking of first. We think of identity pieces, which is important for all the reasons that you've talked about so far, to really think about those groups that historically have been kept out because of identity. But I'm thinking about this a lot lately because I live in Providence, Rhode Island, and this is a question not just about one Reformed congregation. It's about the whole Jewish community of this city. I can draw a mile, about a one square mile, in Providence, and it encloses virtually all of the Jewish buildings, like the synagogue, the Federation, the et cetera, and it's in the upper middle class area of Providence, mm-hmm. And I know, partially because of my age, I'm younger, so I'm in touch with, I think, more people that aren't, you know, in a situation where they're structuring families and living in that area. I mean, I know a lot of people who are in other areas of the town that some of them do want to participate in Jewish life, you know, category one. If only there was stuff in their neighborhood, they would participate. Some of them aren't thinking about it at all, but maybe if there was something close by. And I look at the calendar of all of the institutions here, and I think, like, if I were one of those people who didn't have access to a car as I do, and who live, like, would I be able to participate in Jewish life at all in Providence? And it would be very, very, very hard. And so the question I'm asking basically is, A, if you can talk about how economics plays and location plays in the issue of hospitality, because it's sometimes uncomfortable to talk about that, especially with what we assume to be a suburban norm to Judaism that is not always a real norm, et cetera. And also, how does the work you're doing with individual Reform congregations link to sort of broader work that would be happening in entire Jewish localities across those denominational lines, and maybe even across like kinds of organization, like synagogues working with community centers, working with, et cetera?
Socioeconomics is huge, and it's something that is challenging for us to talk about. You know, on some level, the difference between the two may be negligible. I've chosen to not focus primarily on that to start, because I think in some ways it's harder. It's really fundamental, and because it's interwoven, I take that into account around some of the other issues we're dealing with around race and ethnicity and LGBTQ identity and interfaith families, that I weave that throughout. Because as challenging as that is for some, I try to remind people or let them know that in some ways it's also easier in some ways. Like, it's very concrete whether or not you're inclusive of some of those different groups, and that by beginning to account for some of those issues, which include issues around chronic unemployment and employment discrimination, whether it's around race or disability or gender or sexuality, that's sort of a backdoor way that I have of beginning to account for that. And by getting some of those different populations who have more socioeconomic diversity through the door, we can begin to have that conversation, because I So I'm holding off. So that's an ongoing piece. I have it. I have buckets on my board. I have these like satchels of different groups. And I have like the diversity satchel and the life cycle one and the generational one. And socioeconomics is really big. And there's different levels of our work. A colleague of mine on staff, Gila, she looked over our materials and I thought she said it really well. And we've used it since. And she's like, oh, like you have like mild, medium, and spicy resources here. And that to me is a spicy issue. And so part of what I attribute to me getting to where I've gotten is part around my work ethic and is also has been a very high level of discernment and deciding what is the right amount of pressure and agitation that I think people are ready for and moving them along and finding ways to move the dial forward and then bringing more things up for conversation. A really practical answer in part to response to what you just asked too, which I would add is that we're also looking at, we've started to and want to ramp up some of our resources that are available online. And that's not a long-term solution. Part of me feels like a little icky, which is not to say that, you know, we're just going to avoid having like, hopefully it's very clear that I want us to tackle some of those issues as communities are ready to do it or ready enough, or maybe not so ready, but close enough that we're just going to give it a go. And in the meantime, there are people who like, it's just been long enough. And so we need to find ways of offering introduction to Judaism online and other hopefully programs as well as we look at our next 2 years, we're reaching the 2 year mark. And so you're reaching me at a particular moment this during this part of the year, in the second half of this year, where I'm both very much still in the throes of programmatic implementation, and I've also lifted my head up and I'm at a slightly different altitude and saying, okay, what's working so far and where do we want to really narrow our focus to have a measurable impact on community.
I like that mild, medium, and spicy metaphor because I think it kind of gives a good sense of different ways to approach this stuff. And I would imagine, I mean, tell me if I'm right about this, that most synagogues of all denominations these days are probably more or less in the category where really it would be a big achievement if they took the mild sauce. Give us like some concrete sense of like what mild looks like as regards to various important populations. Like what does mild look like as regard to Jews of color? What does mild look like as regard to intermarried families? What does mild look like as regard to people with disabilities or LGBT people, et cetera?
Great question. What does this look like in practice? And if we were to go through a progression? So I think it starts by a congregation identifying that they're interested in doing this work and that they think their community has something to gain by it, and or that it's a fundamental part of their understanding of Jewish values, a range of Jewish values, whether it's B'Tselem Elohim, the concept that we're all made in the image of the divine, to a range of other values, some of which I noted earlier. And that they're willing to put some resource and time and support behind taking time to do this. So when someone from a congregation downloads our toolkit, there are a range, it walks through a number of different things. So it starts with all of these welcome resources because I know how Jews are and many Jews are like ready to take action and they want to dive in. They don't want to sit around. I mean, they want to do a little bit, like they have need to know enough about process in order to like understand. But once they get that, they just like want to act. So we're like letting them scratch that itch and like, here's a greeter training. Here are 10 practices you can do to help make your synagogue more welcoming on Shabbat. It walks through a number of different things. And then it goes into a deep dive. And one of the resources that I really enjoy and that it has been well received by a number of professional and lay leaders in our movement is our Audacious Hospitality Congregational Self-Reflection, which is a checklist and goes through about 6 different categories that starts with connecting with members, and it has a parenthetical new, so connecting with new members, to interfaith families, encouraging the exploration of Judaism. You know, how do we respond to people who either they're encountering Judaism for the first time or they're returning? It goes through other areas and includes, and so within these, there are varying levels of difficulty, and it allows a congregation to get an overarching sense. It's funny because for a number of the leaders with whom we've worked, they see it as a very long document. And to me, it's a distillation of assessments. I could have produced an assessment that is as long as this one about each one of these subjects. So we tried to distill it and get a broad sense of, do you have something on your website? Are there resources in your library? Does your programming reflect, if you look at your calendar of programming over the year, does it reflect racial and ethnic diversity? If we begin to think of these things not as ancillary, but as part of who we are, which is for me where some of that audacious hospitality shows up, is it internal? It's not just the out here, but it's who are we as a people? And if we are in relationship with our people and we are proximate, then how does that accountability and that relationship get reflected in who's on the BEMA and how we lead board meetings in the different elements that all the different ways that we might express that?
So I'm thinking about, you know, maybe this is sort of goes to spicy, you know, but I'm thinking about how, at least to some extent, the history of LGBT Jews over the last however many decades has been one where not by choice, they created their own synagogues. Mm-hmm. And I think that gave them a certain amount of cohesion and power, ultimately, that when certain things changed in our society, were able to be used as a way to come into non-LGBT synagogues, you know, regular synagogues that have been around for a long time, with some sense of power and confidence. And when we look at other groups, yeah, they seem to come into our synagogues one or two at a time, typically. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so obviously, step one is to recognize that and to become profoundly concerned about the welcoming and the audacious hospitality and make sure that even if folks come in one or two at a time, they are welcomed. But, and maybe, you know, as I'm thinking about audacious hospitality versus hospitality, in my mind, it's like hospitality says, you're welcome in my space. Audacious hospitality is, I'm giving you the keys. It's your space. I hope that you'll welcome me. Something like that, right? And the super spicy version of that is somehow, can I empower you to really come in with an agenda and tell me what it would look like for this place to be the way it should be? And I'm wondering whether maybe being a national organization, maybe the internet, maybe there are other tools that potentially allow those folks who are one or two of them in all sorts of congregations scattered around the country to find one another and potentially to sort of build something new together. And it's going to take time, but eventually they might be able to do the work that essentially the LGBT Jewish community did over all those years, sort of in exile. And I'm wondering if some of that's going on, if some of that's on the agenda, how you think about that. It's fundamentally the innovator's dilemma, which is, you know, how do you get the sort of relatively content people that are, you know, want the synagogue to be how it always was, you know, how do you kind of move them off their, even if it's, you know, how do you move them off their comfort? And even with the best of intentions, it's hard to do that when you're just one or two people coming in.
So I just don't know what to do with you right now, Dan. I'm like, are you a mind reader? Like these are such awesome questions. This is so great. So I love that question. I saw where it was going. You took it even further. I decided not to mention it. So a piece, but now I will, since you brought up a specific piece. Going back to some of the misguided ideals that I find our community has, one of them is around an aversion to affinity groups, or really, and I think a part of that has to do with the legacy that this country has around segregation. But whether it's the LGBTQ movement or pivotal moments for me and my leadership as a woman of color within the Jewish community and how I benefited immensely from the leadership of Yavila McCoy when she first founded and started Ayeka, more than 10 years ago, and it completely enhancing and shifting my understanding of self and what Judaism could look like. When you're in a room with Jews of color that's just Jews of color, all of a sudden, like you do with a number of different affinity groups, even with Jews, you're like, oh, like all that stuff, that like that's not just me. That ain't just me. Like, oh wow, like I'm not the only person with like bodaciously large hair, and like I'm not the only person, I'm not the only Jew who dances with my butt. Like apparently this is a Black Jewish thing, and wow, like I got to see that the observance of halakha, of traditional Jewish law, looks different with women of color. It looks like dancing to Kanye West and to Parliament, and to have this world-opening experience for me, I got to see firsthand. And I remember thinking when Yavila was first coordinating one of these events and I was brought on to be on the advisory team, and she said it was going to be only Jews of color, I remember thinking, somewhat irrationally, like, oh, my mother couldn't go. It was going to be in New York. My mother lives in California. That makes no sense. Like, she was never going to go anyway. But I was like, the theoretical possibility of my white Jewish mother, like, she couldn't go. And I, you know, I had some stuff come up around that, right? But when I was in that space, I got to see that experience had been missing my whole life.
I wanted to flash back to your Yavila McCoy moment. And I wanted to selfishly focus on me for a second and think about my own Yavila McCoy kind of moment. And for me, I'm very privileged. I should name that. I come at this as a white guy with two Jewish parents, with never been questioned whether I, like my Jewish identity has never been questioned. I have all sorts of privileges. The intersection I come at this from is that plus in an interfaith relationship. And so my Yavila McCoy moment, basically what I'm getting at is, to some extent, I don't know if my Yavila McCoy moment has happened. I don't know if I've had that person who is like a big prominent leader, and is speaking from their place of being in an interfaith relationship. There are a few such people in some corners of the Jewish world, but the closest thing I think of to a Yavila McCoy moment is actually not from like the Jewish world, quote unquote. It's from the TV show New Girl. I don't know if for listeners who might watch, it's a TV show about a bunch of friends who live together, and one of them, the Jewish guy, his name is Schmidt on the show. You don't find out his first name till like the fifth season. He gets married to a Hindu woman, and it's this beautiful, incredible ceremony. There is nothing at all about any baggage, about parents being upset about it, or it's just happy and it's just great. And for me, that's the closest thing. And I look at our Jewish world, and when I look at the interfaith program we're doing, we don't seem to have yet fully internalized nothing about us without us. We seem to still be in that mode of, okay, we folks who aren't intermarried or interpartnered or interdating, et cetera, are going to teach people who are stuff about Judaism, et cetera. And I look around and I don't see that many spaces, even in very progressive spots. We're like, this is an interfaith space. This is for people who are in those interfaith relationships. And like, I guess I sort of have a pitch.
let's hear it.
It'd be really cool if, you know, the sequel to this this incredible Jews of Color fellowship that you're describing is some fellowship specifically for people who are in interfaith relationships, not just to be welcomed, but to lead, to be the ones at the front of the table, with the agenda at the table, as we've talked about, you know, different
proverbial. And be out about it.
Yeah. Right? That was mostly a statement. I'm going to now turn it into a question in a semi inauthentic way. But so what do you think about that pitch? And how do we take those next steps where interfaith folks are not just, you know, welcome ease, but welcome ers, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's a phenomenal pitch. And that's actually precisely why we created the Juvenation Fellowship to begin with, believe it or not. The fellowship program's seed funding came from the Avenues to Jewish Engagement for Intermarried Couples and Families Matching Grant Initiative in honor of the 2015 Genesis Prize laureate, Michael Douglas. at its core of the fellowship and throughout the work we're doing with Juvenation, supporting, normalizing, and celebrating diverse interfaith couples and families is central. It's so central in some ways that it's almost invisible, because the way we chose to approach it, at least initially, and it's interesting because as I'm thinking about your question, when we created the fellowship, it was at a particular time period and cultural moment for our community. And now 2 years later, interfaith, the conversation around interfaith couples and families has been pushed to the fore in a more dramatic way. And we have one explicit interfaith project that's called Spiritual Autobiography. There are a few Jews of color, Mizrahi Jews, people engaging in Jewish mindfulness, covering a range of topics that are engaging people who are in interfaith relationships from a range of angles. I think what's in your question, or what your question prompts for me, is a desire that I've had as I've been affected by what's been going on in the communal conversation and world around this piece about interfaith inclusion, and I'm eager to push the envelope further. Speaking of that, my first go-to as you were talking was to think about my own personal experience, because this is both very much an issue that our community has to grapple with, and it's an issue that affects me personally. My parents were turned away from two Jewish communities as an initially interfaith and interracial couple with young children looking to engage in Jewish community in Northern California. You know, now in retrospect, in my position, I can see that most likely the work of the URJ's outreach department had an impact on the kindness and welcoming that my parents were met with when they reached out to a Reform synagogue. But if my parents hadn't continued looking, if the pain had been too much after getting rejected outright twice, I wouldn't be here in this doing this work. All of that to say two things. One, that in talking about this, you know, I want to acknowledge that Juvenation is certainly standing on the shoulders of a number of leaders, clergy, people in the field within the Reform movement who have been stewarding this work and leading this work for decades that allowed me to get to this moment. And it's also true that because of that work and that legacy, I am here. And having grown up with the benefit of that, I also want more. Despite all this progress, there's still barriers. And we still see a disproportion of people who are in interfaith relationships or families, that they are the ones disproportionately on the margins. This is long-term work.
Part of what motivated us to have this series on our show was to probe at the question of whether the kind of radical innovation that we're looking for on this show can only happen outside of the world of institutions and in the sort of startup space or in people's own homes, or whether it can also happen within institutions. And, you know, we've been surprised over the course of doing this show to find actually that there are a number of institutions, whether those are national groups or local institutions, that have more capacity than we might have thought to do some of this work within themselves, but they do have to accept a certain set of self-limitations, right? The idea of tzimtzum, of the idea of God making God's self smaller in order to make space for human beings, you know, that also institutions have to make themselves smaller, or the people who have been in them smaller, so as to make space for others. And it struck me that the Reform movement, both because of ideological openness and demographic realities and leadership, may be in a position to say we can be one of those institutions. And in the business world, I think a lot about the Dayton Hudson Company, which was a department store chain, and they seeing the threat that places like Walmart and Kmart were against them, they incubated Target, and they created this thing that looked more like their competitors than like what they had been in the past. And they had the foresight to say, we can incubate some things that really don't look a lot like what we are today. And if it works, then, you know, then that is another exciting direction. But we can only get there we're not going to get there through small changes. We're going to only get there if we can incubate some of these new ideas in a powerful way. So, you know, I as we sort of close this conversation, I'd love to know what you think about that. Are there things that we haven't asked you about that you think are really important to say? But ultimately, I don't know that there's an answer to that question, but I think it's a really exciting possibility to explore. And I'm really grateful for you to have put out some of the ideas for us today.
How I would respond in closing is to say that, as I guess is kind of obvious since I'm in this role, is that I'm not someone who's discounting the role of synagogues and Jewish institutional life, because in my mind, and admittedly, and so far it's going well, like we're just at the outset, we're just 2 years in of work that's going to take a long time. And I'm a pragmatist, but also a major ambitiously optimist. And to me, like that can't, the answer that, or the conclusion that the synagogue is not the place of innovation, one, I don't think that's true. And two, that's just not enough. Because what that means to me is a bunch of people I love don't have a place in Jewish life. And that's not in a core part of Jewish life. And that's not acceptable to me. I came into this role as a leader and a dreamer, and someone who grew up within the Reform movement and saw the capacity for this movement to lead on some key issues. And if we're really able to convene conversations that can be productive and honest and transparent, I'm hopeful about what's possible. Because to me, there's a certain, I want to say this carefully, there's a certain amount of something that it's easy for someone who has had access to synagogue life and to institutional Jewish life to dismiss it. And part of my work, not only, but an important part of my work is being a voice for people who have not had that opportunity, and who find meaning in it. And through those individuals, I think that there is an opportunity for, it sounds over the top, I'm just going to say it, like I think that there is room and opportunity for there to be a renaissance in Jewish institutional life, because a number of people who are on the fringes are vibrant and interesting and brilliant and have a tremendous amount of grit. And they should, and there's a number of things that we should change so that they don't have to keep tolerating it. But I have spent tens of hours crying and processing the pain and racism and different things I have encountered. And I am still here. And there are literally thousands of Jews with all different kinds of identity all over the country. And my hope is that as we build momentum and as we build more infrastructure in this work, we can connect with more and more of those people to move these important issues forward together.
Wow. Well, thank you, April Baskin, for joining us. I feel like to have in one conversation the amount of sheer passion and enthusiasm, along with a call for the empowerment of people to dance with their booties, I feel like is not totally what I like. It's not something that happens every single show. So thank you for bringing that, and it's been great to have you on.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to April Baskin for joining us, and thanks to all of you out there for listening. We want to close out this episode in the same way we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us with a financial donation, either on a monthly basis, recurring, or just one time. And you can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.